The date is July 13th, 1984, and we're watching The Last Starfighter. Welcome to I Used to Like This One. Hello, and welcome back to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host,
Colin Stewart.
And today, for The Last Starfighter, we have a very special guest joining us via Zoom. I would like to introduce everyone to Kingsley Leung.
Woo!
Hello, Kingsley. Hey. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm also known as the Last Asian.
The Last Asian. Okay. So this week, we're looking back at July 1984, when the movies and theaters were Gremlins, Ghostbusters, Karate Kid, Top Secret, Star Trek III, Conan the Destroyer, The Muppets Take Manhattan, Cannonball Run 2, and of course, our movie for today, The Last Starfighter, which earned $28.73 million on a $15 million budget.
And a warning, obviously, we say this every time, but for anybody who hasn't seen this movie, I mean, it's 36. Math is not my strong suit. 36 years
carry
old.
The one.
So there will be spoilers ahead. So if you don't want the movie to be spoiled for you, hit pause, go watch it, come back, hear what we have to say.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "In his wildest dreams, Alex never suspected that tonight he would become The Last Starfighter." Of course, we do have an ellipses there between become and The Last Starfighter, just to draw out the dramatic tension of that tagline. But that may not be the best description, so we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
All right, here we go. Alex Rogan is a high school senior living in a trailer park with his mom, Jane, and his younger brother, Lewis, in Southern California. He dreams of escaping the trailer park to go to college and pursue bigger and better things, but his hopes get dashed when he gets a rejection letter for a loan that he was hoping for. One of the big things in the trailer park is this game called Starfighter. So Alex, one night, he goes and he plays it, and he breaks the high score, which caused this big celebration in the trailer park.
Huge.
Starfighter is a game where players defend the frontier from Zurin the Kodan Armada in a space battle. After he breaks the record, this old man named Centauri drives into the trailer park and whisks Alex away, and wouldn't you know it, the whole thing was real. And so Alex gets taken to Rylos, where he goes through like the Starfighter training and is told he's going to have to drive one of these gunstars?
Gunstar.
Gunstars. In order to, like the game says, defeat Zurin and save the frontier.
I know for me, my memory of this movie was a little vague. It was one of those films I know I had seen. I knew the plot of. In fact, there's an Ernest Cline novel called Armada. Ernest Cline is the author, of course, of
Ready Player One.
Yeah, and so he's got another book called Armada, which is basically just a ripoff of this plot. So I knew the plot. I knew I had seen it, but I really didn't remember much of the movie until I actually started watching this. And then it all came flooding back. But I know before this rewatch, it wasn't like I had seen it dozens of times before. You know, maybe once or twice in my youth. So, Kingsley, you are a special guest today. What kind of history do you have with The Last Starfighter?
Well, thanks again, Sean, Colin, for having me on. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you know, I think Last Starfighter, for me, just like I think anyone in our generational bracket. It was one of those movies that it's like, it's every kid's dream, right? You play a video game because that's all we did back in the 80s.
Yeah.
You play these video games, you go to an arcade, you play these video games, and you're like, man, wouldn't it be cool if this could be real? Like, if this could just like transform, like if I could be like the Mortal Kombat, or go into space, or, you know, Star Wars. I think this is a few years after Star Wars and Star Trek and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So I think for me, nostalgic wise, it's up there, right? Because it was one of those regular dude, plays this video game and becomes a real thing and gets to go up into space fighting aliens and shooting in a gunship. Like, how cool is that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty sick.
Yeah. Colin, what about you? You usually have a history of not even hearing of some of the movies that we do. What's your history with The Last Starfighter?
Yeah, as is common with our podcast, this is yet another movie I had never heard of or seen.
So. Oh, man.
Now, you also have a history of expecting an entirely different movie. Is this one of those for you, or did you kind of get an idea of what might happen within 5 minutes?
Yeah, this one was a little bit more straightforward. It was just kind of unpacking what The Last Starfighter was gonna mean.
Yeah.
But it seemed pretty clear from the get-go where we were going.
Right on. Okay, let's jump into The Last Starfighter, directed by Nick Castle. He's got 14 credits to his name. The Boy Who Could Fly, Dennis the Menace, Major Payne with Damon Wayans, and Mr. Wrong with Ellen DeGeneres. A bunch of mediocrity in his credits. It's produced by Gary Adelson and Edward O. Deneau.
Just want to jump in with a fun fact on Nick Castle. He was actually the original actor that portrayed Michael Myers in the Halloween franchise.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I heard that.
Right on. Both of those producers, they don't have any credits worth noting. It's written by Jonathan Betiel? Betiel? Beetlejuice? I don't know. he did My Science Project, Theodore Rex, some of the TV's Freddy's Nightmares, CBS Summer Playhouse. So we open the movie on a very heroic theme, which the composer for this movie was Craig Safon. I saw nothing else worth noting in his credits either. And we've got credits over some of the worst CGI effects I've ever seen. I don't understand how, like Kingsley said in the beginning, this is just after Star Wars. Like, this is just after Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
So, yeah, like, because Return of the Jedi was 83. You'd think they would have aped some of the effects from Star Wars instead of trying pure CGI.
But you're also talking about, you're dealing with LucasArts, right?
Like, yeah.
That Goliath of CGI experts. And who are these other people?
That's true. The funny thing is, I found when we got to the end, the company that does the effects is actually called Apogee. Apogee. And I just know as the credit went by, it actually looked like it said apology. So I found that incredibly funny how terrible some of the special effects are in this movie. But so
there's, like, with this movie, I found that I often was watching and feel like it was very Star Wars reminiscent. I mean, they could have learned, they didn't have, like, this story displayed over the sky or whatever.
That's true.
I felt that even the way the theme came in reminded me of how Star Wars starts.
A little bit. It hits you hard. I'm sure in 1984, these were cutting edge effects.
Yeah.
But
I do have a fun fact as well. So
yeah?
I call it.
Okay.
So I heard that the same people that did Tron, so you remember Tron?
Yeah.
So they had some of the people, the CGI experts from Tron, on Last Starfighter.
Oh, okay. Because
they said that there was, like, a lot of similarities with some of their CGI work, right?
Yeah, to me, this movie is a mashup of Star Wars and Tron.
It kind of is.
Okay, so after the credits, we're introduced to the Starlight, Starbright trailer park. And we start to follow Maggie Gordon, who is played by Catherine Mary Stewart. She doesn't have a whole lot of credits to her name. The most notable I wrote down was Weekend at Bernie's. And we are shown around the trailer park where we're introduced to the whole community, the animals all waking up, Grandma listening to her Walkman, you know, all that sort of thing. And we also are introduced to a group of kids running around playing. And with those kids running around playing, it brings us to a very early edition of a segment we like to call Bit Player Spotlight. So, in the memorable role of Lewis's friend, most of which was actually cut from the movie, we have a young man named Richard William Wheaton III, who was born July 29, 1972 in Burbank, California. Although this is his seventh credit and one you'd expect would launch him into fame forever, it wasn't until 1986 that he gained international recognition for his role in Stand By Me, and then even more so in 1987 when he was cast as Wesley Crusher on Star Trek The Next Generation. Oh, did I forget to mention the part where he doesn't go by Richard, but actually Will Wheaton? After playing Wesley on Star Trek for 3 1/4 season, he left Hollywood for 18 months to pursue personal video production, whatever that means, but did return to acting during that time for the occasional Star Trek episode. After his hiatus, he returned to Los Angeles and attended acting school for 5 years at UCLA. Nowadays, he works on many projects. He has a YouTube channel, guest stars on TV shows such as The Big Bang Theory and CSI, a lot of voiceover work on shows like Family Guy and Teen Titans Go, and many other things, especially if they are nerdy. Kind of the king of nerds nowadays, he currently lives in Arcadia, California with his wife and 2 sons. And that is Bit Player Spotlight. That's right. In a very blink and you'll miss him role, we've got Will Wheaton. You see him once running around with the kids, and then there's the bit at the very end where the ship lands and he's amongst the crowd there. So
I was gonna say I watched the movie twice and I never saw him.
Yeah.
And I knew he was there the second time around.
I think you only see the back of his head.
Well, when the ship lands at the end, he's the kid at the very far right of the screen. I always find it funny with these bit players that you never know who's going to be there. So we continue on. We've got Alex Rogan, played by Lance Guest, who was in Halloween 2, Jaws the Revenge, where he played Michael Brody, the son of Chief Brody from the first movie, X-Files, House, JAG, The Wonder Years, a bunch of meh kind of stuff. I'd say that for him, Last Starfighter was probably his biggest credit. And he is now playing the Last Starfighter video game. Now, this is the first bit of the movie that I actually remember vividly. You know, when I was saying at the beginning that it took me a while to remember scenes, this is the first one I remember, is him playing this video game. And man, do they hype up video game playing in this movie.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, in our episode where we did The Wizard, you were very critical of how they play video games in movies. So what was your critique of this one?
Lance Guest, he was better at playing the video games. But I guess maybe I was just too distracted by the intensity around the video games in this case. Because this is where Lewis is cheering him on and telling him what to do and everything. It's just... he's better at pretending how to play a video game, though. So Alex's mom, who is the trailer park maintenance person, she needs Alex to fix Elvira's electricity so he can't go out with his friends. And so all his friends show up in the big red truck, and like all 80s movies, I expected them to be total dicks. You know, like, I completely forgot about this little storyline that has these friends. And they pull up in the big truck. I expect them to be dicks. So I was pleasantly surprised. But the truck they pull up in is their bright red Dodge Ram pickup truck, and that brings us to a segment we like to call Sponsorship Corner. So, as always, one of my favorite things about these old movies is to find blatant product placements that are in the movies. So this week, The Last Starfighter is brought to you by Dodge, Budweiser, Michelob Ultra, Coca-Cola, and Playboy Magazine. Plus, make sure to buy the Atari video game and the Berkeley novelization of the movie. Both of those are advertised during the credits. And that is Sponsorship Corner. So Maggie and the squad take off. Alex goes about his chores in the trailer park. And then we find him sitting in his room, staring for a crazy long time at his Planet Mobile. Why is this scene like 2 minutes long? He's just sitting on his bed staring at this mobile. I don't understand it.
I think we all know why. Why does any you know, person that any young person sitting in their room for 2 minutes, but what do they do?
So you're going there with it. Okay.
Well, I mean, there's a sack of Playboys.
It's like in much older movies where that's true. It's like in much older movies, like from the 50s and everything like that, where the love scenes start and they decide to pan the camera over to the curtains and show the curtains blowing. That's what you're talking about is, okay, we're not going to show what Alex is doing here, but he's looking at Uranus. And
The one thing I loved about that scene is how hard they go to show you that Alex really wants out of the trailer park. Like, it starts out with the zoom up on a poster of a beach scene. It pans over to the Eiffel Tower. Then he sits on his bed, looks at the planets. It's just like, how do I get out of here?
Well, you know, I found it kind of neat because I don't think I ever saw a movie that the surrounding is in a trailer park. Like all these other sci-fi movies, they're all like, you know, in some big city or even a small town, but they're in a trailer park. I always found that kind of interesting.
Well, and that's also something that I noticed too, is that with this trailer park, for a 1984 movie, we've received so much more like cultural diversity already than we have in most of the other 80s movies. Like when we did The Goonies, it's a very white town that they live in, you know, things like that. Whereas here we finally got some black people. We finally got, you know, it's not a whole lot, but it's more than like the one token black guy. You know, it is nice that, yeah, it's a unique environment to put them in. And they were finally a little bit more forward thinking with their casting of something. So, now we've got Alex. He's done whatever he did in his bedroom, and he's back playing his video game at night, and he's about to break the record, and every fucking neighbor in the entire trailer park comes to watch. This is the biggest neighborhood news ever. Like, how many people have you ever seen that get a crowd like this? Like, I used to hang out in arcades a little bit when I was younger. Have you ever seen a group like this gather around? I mean, I think that's one of the myths of these kind of movies. Like, I've never been in a casino where I see people screaming around a craps table. I've never been in an arcade where people are like, this is the biggest news that's hit the Starlight Starbright in, I don't know, ever.
Well, one of the things I read, and it kind of makes sense in that aspect, is the screenwriter Jonathan Boutel, or however you pronounce it.
Beetlejuice. It's got a really weird spelling. B-E-T-E-U-L, like, I don't know.
But he kind of conceived the premise of this movie as similar to Sword in the Stone. So, I don't know if you watch Sword in the Stone, but it's like everybody comes around to see who's going to pull the stone out, the sword out of the stone. And so when I read that, I was like, oh, it makes sense why they have the entire community come and watch and play this game. Like, it's the biggest thing that ever happened in the trailer park.
But at least with Sword in the Stone, you know that that guy's going to become king. Like, true. That's what the legend of the sword is. No one knows that this game is going to, like, call some sort of intergalactic being to help him join some, you know, space force nobody knows about.
Well, the one thing I thought was crazy, they're talking about how he's going to break the highest score at first. It's not even that he's going to beat the game.
Yeah.
He's going to beat the highest score. So who... They never mentioned who set the highest score before, and maybe if you beat the highest score, you become king of the trailer park.
It's got to be him, because he's the only one that's ever playing the game, right?
No, beat himself, basically.
Yeah, exactly. That's okay. Fine. You know, it's like a golfer saying, I managed to, you know, wipe a stroke off my game. Yeah. He's just playing against himself. But this is what it's like before console games, right? So he gets the high score. Alex and Maggie kiss. Little brother Lewis.
I have one more.
Oh, okay, thing. Yeah.
When he's playing the game, I found it so creepy when Maggie's like, "Good boy, Alex." She's like, "That's it. That's her encouragement."
You got this, champ. You know, yeah. And so at the end of it, Alex and Maggie kiss. The little brother Lewis says diarrhea. Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about that line that you just said. Good boy, Alex. Diarrhea. Oh wow, I can't believe that was a thing. Maybe it was one of those lines that they were hoping would catch on as, you know, a kid's version of being able to say shit. I don't remember 1984 well enough to know if that was the case. So mom comes home from whatever she was off doing, and he's still bragging. Oh, she was at work. That's right. Yeah. And Alex is still bragging about his record game and that she has his scholarship rejection letter that was delivered to her work instead of her home.
Yeah.
Like, is this that small of a town that the mailman's just like, oh, well, I'm in here eating eggs. I'm in here eating all day breakfast. You know, maybe I should just drop this off to her. She can take it home. That way I don't have to drive out to the trailer park. So we've got that emotional scene where he finds out that he's not going to go anywhere. But meanwhile, the Starfighter game is going just absolutely berserk, rocking back and forth on itself, just going absolutely nuts, like R2-D2 with a secret. But I'm no expert on internal components of arcade games, but would it rock like that? I don't think that any video game in a big stand-up cabinet is designed to be able to actually physically move like that. Well,
that one's different, right? It's trying to communicate with the mothership. So, you know, like...
And it's not from this world, so...
That's true. And so this is now the part where we are introduced to Centauri, played by Robert Preston. He's got 76 credits. His top four on IMDb are Victor Victoria, Music Man, SOB, and The Last Starfighter. His first credit is The King of Alcatraz in 1938. So this is a guy that was acting for a long time. And this was one of his last movies because he died in 1987. But he's driving what looks like a pimped out DeLorean. I kind of wonder whether this was an inspiration for Back to the Future a year later. Or did they see that and go, wow, that looks cool. That's what I want to use as my time machine.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I'm just going to say it anyways. But I remember seeing in a Back to the Future documentary that the guy who made the DeLorean wanted the car to be so popular, so he actually shopped it around to a bunch of like movies to put it in the movie so that it would kind of gain popularity, but it never really did.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Yeah, so yeah, it looks like a DeLorean. It's complete with the gull wing doors even. And the Centauri is looking and talking like a 1930s newspaper man. You know, he's got the bow tie and the fedora, and he's just like, "Hey, kid, what's the story? Well, you know, I'm looking for Alex. Who are you? You know." But just talking like a fast-talking newspaper man. I love it. He was awesome. And then, so Alex gets into this car, and he gets zapped by Beta. And we were left to wonder what that was all about. And then he decides to take Alex for a ride in his weird limo DeLorean that he's got. And he's being purposely cryptic the whole time and not telling Alex anything. And apparently driving 303 miles per hour, which is what the cop speed gun clocks him at. And then the car transforms and turns into a spaceship. And my God, did they try so hard on these special effects. Like, I gotta give them an E for effort, at least. But, I just... The special effects just kept taking me out of it.
Because, I wanted to ask, like, you both watched it, like, when it was kind of new, like, yeah, in your youth. So, like, when you first saw that car when you were a kid, was it cool?
I think it was pretty cool. Because it's like, you know, this is, 30 years ago, right? So
36, yeah.
Yeah, so back, you know, back then, these concept cars have never been out before, and you know, these kind of like futuristic looking vehicles were all pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah.
See, I feel like I probably didn't see this in theaters. I'd have to say that my memory of it is probably on VHS a few years after it came out. So by that time I already knew about the car in Back to the Future. So it's still a cool car. And
my question is,
yeah,
Was Alex so desperate to get out of that trailer park that he went with this complete stranger in a strange car and the strange story and no background whatsoever? I'm like, why would you get into that car?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's the thing about 80 movies. I can see why Stranger Danger became such a big thing in the 90s. Because in the 80s, all kids watched were movies where people got in cars with strangers.
Yeah, I mean, like, this guy, he just has a cool car. He didn't even offer him some candy or a puppy or anything.
Exactly. That's crazy.
So, yeah, so now they're flying through space. Alex is coming to grips with the majestic nature of being in space. And this scene kind of reminds me of the first Star Trek movie, the Star Trek, the motion picture, or 2001 Space Odyssey, because there's a whole lot of just watching the space fly by, right? Like, that's something that Star Trek and 2001 both have, is these long establishing shots where you get to see space and get to see the space stations. The problem is that in these long silences in this movie, we're forced to look at shitty special effects and, you know, just stars. Yeah, it doesn't quite have the same impact, but it's almost like they're trying to rip it off, because like there's a solid minute where it's just him staring out the window. It's like the planets. So yeah. Is he just, you know, taking care of business in the back seat again? Like he's just an insatiable guy. Yeah, so yeah, we're flying along and Satori takes his face off just for fun, you know, just so that we can know that he's not a human, he's an alien. He takes it off, puts it back on. I love how they have to use the handkerchief, and what a terrible
I thought he was like washing his eyes.
Yeah,
you know how old guys would wash their glasses. Yeah. That's what it looked like.
Yeah.
That wasn't scary.
Just straight up takes his face off.
Yeah, it wasn't even a scary thing, right? It was more like, it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Like, you weren't like, oh my God. It was more like, what's he doing?
Yeah. It's one of these situations that lets you know, okay, this is real. You're actually in space, Alex. This guy took his face off. So they land at the base on Rylos. And Centauri just books it the fuck out of there. I love this when he parks the car and then, like, he's gone. Like, it's almost like he was sitting there with his seatbelt off, just ready to hop out of the car. And he disappears. And why did he separate from Alex? Like, he comes back later to give us exposition and all that sort of thing in just a few minutes. But he takes off and leaves Alex with all these people that don't speak English. I don't understand it. Like, he's going through this screening process. Centauri can obviously talk with everyone, but he just hightails it. But he comes back later, like, everything's normal, and I don't quite understand why he did that. And they end up equipping him with a translator, which I don't understand why this wasn't the first step. Why didn't he step out of the car and they clip the translator to his collar automatically so that he... Like, I don't understand why. Like, I guess it's just to, once again, just prove that everything that you're watching is, in fact, real aliens and all that sort of thing. It just, the logic of it. If you're trying to recruit people into your Star Force, why are you doing it in a way that's going to terrify them right off the bat? I don't understand it. So meanwhile, back on Earth, we get to meet the creepy Alex clone, which is Beta. So that's what we find out, is that's why he got zapped in the car, is to make this Beta. And we get to see the mushy blob halfway through transformation Alex. We go back to Rylos, and we've got that moment of, oh shit, it's real, because he comes into the meeting that's taking place with Indurin, played by K.E. Cooter. He was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine at one point. Yeah, and he's giving his speech, and everyone is yelling victory or death. And all of a sudden, Alex is like, whoa, shit, this has gotten real here. What's funny is one of the computer effects that happens on the screens there, I found it to be very reminiscent of one of the computer effects from Star Wars. And it's like, okay, of all the Star Trek effect or Star Wars effects to rip off, it's this one. It's the one with the little blue, whatever, wireware type effects. You know, it's the one that they rip off. In Star Wars, it's the Death Star. But in this one, yeah, it's, you know.
Oh, okay.
That kind of wire. You know, like, why is that the effect that you steal from Star Wars? We end up introduced to the giant head of Xur, played by Norman Snow, who has no significant credits as well. I've noticed a lot of these people, they were either very established actors, or this was it for them. This is where they peaked. Norman Snow, though, interestingly, was on four different soap operas. He was on Days of Our Lives, Another World, General Hospital, and As the World Turned. He did multiple episodes of every one of those, which I did find interesting that he was a soap opera bouncing around kind of guy. But he's our whiny 80s adult daddy's boy for this movie. Every movie's got to have one. And there's something about no eyebrows that makes someone look really creepy. I've always noticed that in movies.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of the Rylan look of, like, no eyebrows and weird skull cap hair.
Yeah. You know, I just, these guys, like, okay, I'm giving the effects a really hard time. I will say that the makeup in this movie is pretty solid. Like, the makeup is on point.
Well, when they had Beta, I think that, like you said, the effects weren't fantastic, but I think for its time, that was kind of freaky. You know,
the practical effects are fine. It's when they do the CGI, and you know that someone was so proud of that CGI, and now it's like, that's the opening of a Super Nintendo game now. So yeah, so we get to see the evil Xur. He's in the middle of having his argument with Indurin over whatever teleconference or whatever you want to call it in space. He's defected from the Starfighter Corps, and he proves his point by torturing someone on screen until their face melts. I kind of wonder about the face melting scene.
Like, well, they had to think of something. Like, there had to be some sort of, you know, consequence.
I suppose. I guess... It seems kind of intense compared to
the whole rest of the movie. They wanted to be more violent, but at the time, they couldn't have any like blood or anything because it would have upped the rating to an R, and they wanted to keep it PG.
I see. Well, that makes sense. So we learn that he is backed by other aliens. Lord Krill, played by Dan Mason, whose IMDb profile picture is this character. And wearing symbols on their collars that look very much like Hydra symbols. Did you notice that? I felt like saying Hail Hydra when I saw them. Because they've got like these weird, almost octopus-looking appellates on their collars.
Hilarious.
And they're talking about how they want to get through the frontier. Now, I'm no expert on space, but how does the frontier work?
Well, it's like a force field, basically.
Yes, but...
made of drones.
But now, last time I checked, isn't space infinite?
Then why is it called the final frontier?
Well, that's true. Yes. But I like to pretend that Star Trek movie never happened. But still, like we've got this wall of drones that's making up a force field. You're in space. Couldn't you just go over it or under it or around the edges? Like it's obviously a man-made frontier. How is this a barrier that's completely impenetrable? I don't understand the science behind it.
Well, it's also strange because the frontier encapsulates both Rylos and Earth. And we know that Rylos is clearly outside of our galaxy, so it'd be a really huge force field.
this is a wall that Donald Trump is jealous of.
Space wall.
Space wall.
Space wall. Paid for by the aliens.
So, yeah, Alex decides that victory or death and face meltings is just too much to handle. So he decides, fuck this shit. Take me home, Centauri. But not before we have a chance to meet Grig, who is played by Dan O'Herlihy. He's got a whole bunch of credits. 136 credits dating back to 1947 when he was in Hungry Hill. 1948, Orson Welles' Macbeth. He played Macduff. He was in RoboCop 1 and 2. He's probably the most famous person in this movie, other than Will Wheaton. Centauri takes Alex home. Meanwhile, on the base, we find out that there's an inside man to act as a saboteur who causes the biggest explosion ever with, like, a fistful of C4. a plastic-type substance, sticks it to the desk, but somehow just absolutely decimates this base. And so the frontier is now prone to attacks, and they make asteroids crash into the base. And this is where I just couldn't handle the special effects anymore, because they've got this terrible mix of CGI with like practical blue screen effects.
Oh yeah. So like with these, right? Explosions.
Boom. Yeah, like so the asteroids are CGI, the base is CGI, but the explosions themselves are actual explosions, but it's done so badly and like the mix of it is so jar. I hated the special effects, okay? Like
yeah, you got it.
Tell us how you really feel.
That's the thing is the story itself and it's fun. Like there's some parts where it just gets convoluted and weird plot points that don't really make a lot of sense, but the movie itself, the idea of the movie itself is still very enjoyable, but yeah. But the effects, anyway, so Alex is back on Earth, and oh boy, the mistaken identity with Alex, Beta, and Maggie, me and my, how did you put it, strange sexual urges aren't talking to you. You gotta love the love triangle, or the mistaken identity love triangle. It's an 80s staple.
Yeah.
So Alex discovers Beta in his room. You can definitely tell that split screen was also a newer technology when they did this, because Alex is so bad at talking to himself. And like, the delivery of his lines is just absolutely terrible. But he gets in an argument with Beta because Beta is there while he's away. And so Alex storms out with his line to Lewis, because Lewis has been eavesdropping. "Shut up or I'm telling about your playboys." And then Lewis ends up seeing the other Alex and says, "What the shit?" And he said, "I said, shut up or I'm telling about your playboys." Does Lewis think he's dreaming? How does he not question this further? Does Alex have that much of a hold on Lewis that, is he that scared of his older brother that he shares a room with?
With playboys. That's kind of scary.
It is, I suppose. But he doesn't have a very good hiding spot for them either.
Everybody knows that playboys are supposed to be stored in a log in the woods.
That's right. Especially in the 80s. The bad guys have ended up finding him on Earth. But Centauri shows up in time to save the day. But ends up getting shot in one of the lamest laser gun fights ever. it's such a low stakes fight that's going on here. Like, the choreographer of this fight,
I found it. That shootout is hard to watch. Like, the Zandozan literally doesn't move.
Yeah,
but he's shooting down, even though he's clearly shooting across. And then Centauri is just kind of like, pew, like shooting up. And somehow his little laser cuts off the arm. And I don't know.
And you can almost hear them saying, kapew, kapew. So Centauri ends up taking a belly shot. But Alex has decided that, okay, Beta's got it under control back here. Okay, I'm going to go back. And even as he's dying, Centauri manages to fly back, but crashes in the hangar. And once he crashes in the hangar, this is the point where Centauri is having his final moments. He's dying, but there's such a small sense of urgency about the fact that he's dying and trying to save his life. Like, it's like, hey, how about get some help, guys? How about try to save Centauri's life? Because he's still alive at this point. But you just kind of mosey around over to the driver's seat and see if he's okay. And,
I mean, it makes sense once you get to the end of the movie.
I suppose so.
He thought he could just take off layers of skin. Just like he took his face, just take off layers of skin, and he'll be healed.
That's right. He can just peel his belly off. But maybe he didn't have his handkerchief in his pocket to be able to do the effect. And then after he dies, Alex has a very flat line. And after Greg does the dead body eye closing thing with his fingers, but Alex sits there and goes, "Centauri! Centauri! Centauri!" Like, it's the flattest delivery. It's like, this is the point where you're supposed to be screaming to the heavens, and no, you killed
Centauri. Camera from up above. Right?
Yeah. This is supposed to be like when Darth Vader kills Ben Kenobi.
Yeah, exactly. Wait, Darth Vader? Ben, what?
Oh, sorry, wrong.
What?
Hold on, yeah, I had to back up there. Wait, we're talking about two different movies.
Are we, though?
No, Ben. Oh, when... Ben Kenobi. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I guess, yeah. I'm the idiot. Oh, my God. I've been talking about Star Wars the entire way through this episode, and you just beat me on that. So we find out that the ship has, or sorry, the base has been attacked while we're gone, and there's only one ship left, and it's the prototype Gunstar. And twist... there's only one starfighter left as well. The Last Starfighter, in fact.
Oh, that's the title of the movie.
Yeah, they wink and give a thumbs up to the camera. I am the Last Starfighter. Ah, see what I did there? So he gets a tour around this ship from Grig, who I still don't quite understand what Grig's role is in the actual ship. I don't understand what
his role is. Isn't he like a co-pilot navigator?
Yeah. So
this is based on the actual like World War One or World War Two like Air Force, where they had like a navigator and a gunner. So the starfighter is the gunner who his only job is to shoot things.
But he's also flying.
No, he's not.
Is he not flying?
He's not flying. Grig is doing the flying.
Okay, see, like, I was under the impression that he was also, like, Alex was flying and gunning.
No.
I don't think so.
Okay, so we get a look around the cockpit, and we find out it's just like the video game, except for the one mystery button.
The Death Blossom.
The Death Blossom, which we are going to find out about later. Back on Earth, we get treated to a little bit more of Beta. We get treated to him taking his head off to repair something because his hearing's not working properly. And so while his head is off and sitting on the desk, Lewis wakes up once again and he tells Lewis that, Lewis, you're dreaming. Now go back to sleep.
I have to say, this is my favorite scene in the entire movie.
Oh, was it?
Okay. I love all the Beta stuff. I could have watched a movie that was just like an alternative cut where it was just Beta on Earth and we just follow him.
So kind of like Crocodile Dundee or Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Him learning to become someone that can blend in.
Yeah.
It's a very Encino Man type story. How many more of these references do I have?
I totally watch a spinoff with just Beta. Be like, Beta, not L. I don't know.
You could make it into a whole series.
Yeah, I mean, I love that scene. And then adventures. I love later on when he gets to Beta and Maggie, like, at Silver Lake. And he just, they're like making out or whatever. He just finally just gives up and he's like, fuck it. I'm a robot.
Yeah, so I just love the line though, you're dreaming, now go back to sleep. But he sees more bad guys land, so he knows that he doesn't have much time left. And when he reaches down and shakes his own head on the desk. But we see him learning how to do stuff like hanging antennas. Kids today have no idea that, you know, this thing that's hanging on the side of their trailer. This used to be where TV came from, kids. he's learning how to wiggle his eyebrows. He's laughing and navigating his love life, like you said, at the lake. He definitely copies the wrong douchebag there, though. Because yeah. he's imitating exactly what one of the other guys is saying. And he ends up copying all those other girls meant nothing.
I love it. You want me to talk dirty to you now?
And so, yeah, so this is, like you said, this is where Beta can't take it anymore. So he confesses. And conveniently right there, like he was just waiting in the shadows for him to confess, the bad guy shows up and shoots him. And he says, see? Because you can see all his components and glowing bits in his chest. And then we're back in space and we see Alex and Grig are going to take on the entire enemy fleet because they have the element of surprise because all the bad guys think that all the starfighters have been killed. And so they do a bit of a blitz attack and then hide. Are they hiding in an asteroid? I could never quite understand where they were. And the shitty effects didn't help me figure it out easily. Like maybe I just looked up or something or looked down from my from the screen when they actually flew into the asteroid. It's just all of a sudden they've got these weird gray walls all around.
Well, they chase one Coden fighter into the asteroid and destroy it.
That's true. Alex
gets his first kill.
Yeah.
And then they talk about how they need to take out that little thing on the bottom of the main ship so that communications. All the other fighters of their army will be thrown into disarray so that they can kill all them and then go after the big ship.
That's right. So they, so they attack and then hide. And then Alex and Greg just kind of hang out and discuss their chances and discuss their lives back home. You know, and we've got Alex trying to explain the idea of living in caves, but he lives in caves that are mobile, but explains that they're also not mobile because they're actually item. It is interesting trying to explain a trailer park though to an alien race. But speaking of back home, they have stolen their friend's red Dodge Ram truck, and Maggie is taking the news of imposter Alex a little too well. Like, don't you think she just accepts it so easily? Like, she seems to accept it faster than Alex, who was flying into outer space on an actual spaceship.
Yeah.
She's just like, okay, whatever, you're a robot.
What makes no sense is that she finds out that Beta isn't Alex, sees he's a robot, jumps in the truck, they chase down the Zandozan. Beta drives the car into the antenna thing, blows it up, and dies.
Yep.
And then Maggie just is like, I love you, Alex Rogan. And wouldn't all that experience just really lit the fire?
Because it's not Alex. Like, is she realizing that if Alex did actually die in a fiery crash, that she would be sad? Like, did this bring up memories in or feelings in her that made her realize that she would actually be devastated by him blowing up in a...
Maybe she had, like, this image in her mind that she's like, Alex is, like, he's so worldly. He's so yeah. giving, you know? And if he dies, it's because he saved, like, 1,000 people. A million people, whatever.
Well, and she also looks up to the stars, so maybe she can just see him. I mean, they obviously don't understand the physics of space, so maybe she can actually see him standing up there. I'm not sure. But yeah, so like you said, they crash into the antenna because the bad guy is sending a transmission back to Xur. And Beta crashes the truck into him, and we get classic misunderstanding because only half the message is received by Xur. So it's, they receive the message that says, the last starfighter is, and that's all they receive in the transmission. So Xur finishes it and says, dead. The last starfighter is dead.
Another alternative cut of this movie I would watch would be the command center of Xur with those other two Kodan guys who just clearly hate him with a fiery passion because they're like, the message is clearly incomplete and he just finishes it and we're like supposed to go with that. So yeah.
this reminds me of, I don't, for those who know Three's Company, this is classic misunderstanding every episode.
Oh, always. Oh, any 80s sitcom. It doesn't just have to be Three's Company.
That's what it reminds me of. It just reminds me of that classic, you know, Jack, overheard something, and it was a misunderstanding. Janet did this.
Yeah.
Classic.
So with those two guys, which one is Chrissy? And like, is Xur Jack in this equation? He must be, right? The other two guys are a different race, so that would be like having a different gender.
Yeah, he's just playing with his weird spiky bat scepter and
so we're back to Greg and Alex, and Greg is trying to hype Alex up to fight. He's showing pictures of his family, showing what Alex or what he's fighting for and everything like that.
Funny fact I read about that is that with Greg O'Herlihy.
Dan O'Herlihy.
He played, whatever, Dan?
Beetlejuice?
Yeah. He also played Grig's wife for those pictures, so he's really just looking at pictures of himself.
he's hyping up the real Alex to fight and ends up guilt tripping him with his, "Oh, but too bad there aren't any starfighters left." But it works because Alex is like, "Wait a minute, I'm the last starfighter. There is a starfighter left. It's me." So it was a comment about hide and seek that inspires him to come out. And I don't quite understand, though, how this move is actually hide and seek.
Well, it's because, it's reverse hide and seek. It's like the seeker is hiding in the asteroid waiting for the ships to pass and then surprise, kill you all from behind.
So, okay, as a kid, did you ever play hide and seek where, as the seeker, you hid for a little while and hoped that someone got tired of hiding and walked past you? Like, I just don't understand how hide and seek is the inspiration for this.
I think it's called shake and bake. You go in, you hide, you shake, and then you bake!
Yeah. Isn't kick the can? Kick the can is where you hide and try to beat the seeker, right?
I thought was just a version of soccer with a. I didn't realize there were actually rules to that. I thought it was like soccer with a can.
Yeah, because, just the first person to kick the can, I thought. Something like that.
Oh, see, I don't know. Capture the flag? I don't know which one is more appropriate. Like, he's just. They sneak up behind him. That's not hide and seek. I don't know. So we have a very slow and unexciting battle that happens. Like, this is where you see where the CGI really lets them down, because like they just don't have the frame rate to keep up with a very fast, exciting battle. And when all hope looks lost and they're surrounded by the enemy, the mystery button comes back into play and they do the Death Blossom, which, man, the Death Blossom looks fun.
That was kick-ass. I would love to be in a ship when it does that.
Yeah.
Just like place. And but it's interesting because when you said that, didn't you say that the writer or whatever was also one of his credits was Karate Kid?
I think it was the director.
Was that the writer or director or something? But it just reminds me of, you know, when they do this death crane or whatever it's called. It's kind of like in Karate Kid when he does the crane at the end. It's only last move.
Oh no! Wait, we're giving the production team on this movie too much credit. It's just in theaters at the same time as Karate Kid. Yeah, none of these people actually had anything to do with the Karate Kid. So if you were in 1984 and you were choosing between a movie, you got to go see the one that has the real Karate Kid.
Well, maybe unless you wanted to have the you know the crane with the CGI stuff in it.
I was gonna say it again reminds me of Star Wars with the red button, the warp speed or the light speed. Sorry.
Light speed. But this leaves them powerless for a little while because it takes all their energy to do the Death Blossom. So Lord Krill, who has now taken over the ship by hostile takeover, decides to go ramming speed to take out the Gunstar. And there's this moment where when their ship is going in for ramming speed, it shows Alex and Grig sitting in their own cockpit and they look up like they can hear this thing coming. Now, again, I'm no expert on outer space, but I don't think they'd be able to hear that ship coming. I'm pretty sure space is a vacuum, isn't it?
You're right. Maybe the radars. They had radars. Like, sensors.
Maybe, but they don't actually have any sound effects of any alarms going off or anything. They just, it's like they hear it coming and they look up and start looking out the window and... Like, maybe they should have hired an astrophysicist to read through the script or something like that. But, yeah, Grig explains away some technical thing. There's some technical thing that Alex asks, and Grig explains it away by saying, "I won't bore you with the details." I think this is where they just kind of ran out of ideas of things that they could put in the script. So they manage to evade them, and the enemy ship gets caught in the moon's gravitational pull, and they have the line, "What do we do now? We die." And
bum, bum, bum.
The last starfighter wins. Victory. What do we do now? Let's go get Maggie. So they go back home, and they're landing their ship at the trailer park. Walkman Granny is there, except she's traded in her Walkman for a shotgun. Mom comes up, you know, and she sees Alex. "Alex, what is this?" And now here's something that, like, I joke about things, but I legitimately don't understand this. Greg starts meeting everybody in the trailer park. Has he learned how to say hello in English? Because he's got the translator on his collar, but that's for him, isn't it?
Isn't that a two-way translator? You don't think it's a two-way?
Well, let's see. If it's a two-way translator, you'd think that everybody was talking alien languages in the beginning, when Centauri dips on them, right? Mm-hmm. There is that part where everyone is speaking an alien language. If it's two-way translator, wouldn't they all be wearing one? See, there we go, right? So he's saying hello to everyone. Hello, pleased to meet you. Hello. But he doesn't speak English. Maybe he does.
Maybe during the time that they were in the spaceship together, they really bonded and he figured out some basic words.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't see Greg before he got the translator, so we don't for sure know that Greg doesn't know.
That's true.
English.
We do meet him after Alex already has the translator. It is possible. Yeah, I mean, Greg does seem awfully worldly. He does seem to know what's going on all over the place. Yeah, so he greets everyone, and he has his little greeting, which when Lewis mimics his little greeting, like chest pound, arm out thing, and Lewis's is dangerously close to a Heil Hitler. Maybe you guys should have like come up with some like forehead chest bump or something, something that it doesn't involve sticking your hands straight out from your body. And so now we've got Alex has obviously learned how to guilt trip from Greg, because he gives Maggie the ballsiest ultimatum ever. It's kind of like, we gotta go now. Are you coming or what?
I forgot to mention this at the top of the show, but did you guys know that Catherine Mary Stewart, who plays Maggie, is from Edmonton, Alberta?
Yeah. Oh, shit.
Home of the show.
Really? You know that?
I knew that. And she was from here. She was on a cover. You know, there used to be a magazine called Edmonton. And she was on the cover once. So I got, obviously, when this movie came out in the 80s.
Okay.
And then she moved to California, and that's where she landed on soap opera. I think she was on Days of Our Lives or something like that.
Oh, wow. Okay. See, I didn't actually move to Edmonton until about 87. Yeah, so this would have been, that wasn't big news to me. I know Bruce McCullough from the Kids in the Hall went to my high school.
Oh,
and I know
really?
Leslie Nielsen went to Vic Comp. So I know both those guys spent time. And of course, Nathan Fillion.
Everyone knows that.
I mean, we talked about Will Wheaton, but uber nerdy guy Nathan Fillion is also from our neck of the woods. Yeah, so Maggie decides to go, and because they got to go before the censors pick them up. And we seem to get set up for a sequel that must have never happened, because Maggie and Alex leave. What is she going to do? Like, we've never seen her playing the video game. Is she going to be a starfighter, or is she just going to be like space wife?
She's going to be a starfighter's wife.
Starfighter's wife. She's just going to be at home waiting for him to return from war. And then also, as part of the setup for the sequel, we see Lewis is taking up the mantle of video game player in the trailer park. And that's where we end the movie, is with Lewis playing the video game.
I'm shocked that there wasn't a sequel, because they put so many scenes to clearly set one up, like showing Xur escape, the stuff with Lewis at the end.
Oh, yeah. There's for sure going to be a sequel.
Well, these days, with everything being rebooted and new sequels, I wouldn't be surprised if they did one 36 years later. because they do that with everything else right now. But this is a movie that didn't even double its budget. So I guess they it was a $15 million budget and it only made 28 point whatever million. So they probably couldn't justify it. But that's The Last Starfighter. So Colin Kingsley, on IMDb, it scored a 6.8 out of 10. That's 37,000 reviews for that one. The critics' Metascore on IMDb, it scored 67. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 74%. That's the audience score is 74%. And a critics' rating of 69%. No, sorry, I screwed that up. Sorry. 74% is the critics' score. The audience score is 69%. 47,000 reviews there. Where does it fall for you?
Before we get to that, let's take it to Critics Corner.
Critics Corner.
I just wanted to read out some of the actual reviews that came in.
Okay.
All right. So first we'll start with friend of the show, Roger Ebert. He said that while The Last Starfighter is not a terrifically original movie, the video concept seems to be inspired by Walt Disney's Tron and the battles in space are such close copies of the Star Wars movies that George Lucas might have a lawsuit. David Anson from Newsweek said that the director Castle has studied his Spielberg well. While the movie may be composed of borrowed parts, it remains bouncy and good-natured throughout. Guest has charm and deft comic touch, and Stewart is lovely as his girl. Variety says, with The Last Starfighter, director Nick Castle and Jonathan Dwittel Beetlejuice have done something so simple it is almost awe-inspiring. They've taken a very human story and accented it with sci-fi special effects rather than the other way around. TV Guide states, clever, exciting, and fun, The Last Starfighter boasts good performance by Guest and Preston, a literate, funny skip that highlights scripts, that highlights the real story, not the space war that only Guest can win, but the difficulty of leaving home, family, and security for a totally new life when the opportunity presents itself. The special effects, computer-generated rather than Star Wars-type models, work rather well, giving the film an odd but effective look. And then I have one more. I just happened to find it when I was on Instagram searching Last Starfighter hashtags. But this comes from Instagram user Forced to Create, who says, terrible movie. Creature concepts are mediocre. The computer animation overrated. A substandard stereotypical villain. The Last Starfighter might have sounded something to hint at being cool, but just, IMO, didn't quite get it. But then, 1 minute later, he writes, good alien designs. And that's Critics Corner.
Oh, there we go. He kind of agrees with me. The makeup is good. Everything else, meh. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, as I said, we've got 6.8 out of 10. We've got 67% from the critics. We've got 69% on Rotten Tomatoes and 74% from those critics. So I don't know, where is everyone? We're sitting at about 70% is kind of the average. How do you feel about this movie?
I don't know. I think for me, I'm going to give it a little lower score, like maybe like a 61 and a quarter.
61 and a quarter.
Yeah, and the only reason why I think is because the whole story, to me, just from what I said from the onset, is that you have to suspend your disbelief. And the central theme of this movie is the fact that I want to be that dude that gets to go up to space because I played a video game, right? I want like that reality and imaginary fantasy is what I think a lot of guys and a lot of girls at that time, that's what they were thinking about. And that's all they cared about. Who cares that the special effects were shit? Who cares if, the scenes were not maybe well choreographed or well written, but the concept I think was what I give it at least half the movie, and that's the reason why I enjoyed it.
Is it better or worse than you remember it?
I when I watched it again, I thought it was slightly better because I think I didn't back then. I'm not saying that I'm a movie buff now, but I've seen way a lot, like tons of movies since then. the last 30 years, probably way more movies in the last 10 years. But, you know, I judge a movie by its watchability now, right? If I watch a movie now and I enjoy it just as much as I did the first time and I can watch it over and over again, that's a good movie. But this one, I found myself, I probably wouldn't watch it the third time.
Okay. Colin, high 60s, low 70s? Come on, what do you think? You've never seen it before.
Yeah. Shockingly, I think I'm going to side with the critics on this one. I think I would go with the 70%.
Really?
And okay. I agree with Kingsley in terms of I didn't expect this movie to be watchable at all. For a movie that, like, it's hyped as being, you know, like, the first, one of the first CGI movies, and I was like, and then the CGI is, like Sean will say, intensely terrible.
Intensely terrible.
But the story is so fun and relatable, and yeah, just the beta story was really fun, and it had laughs, it had some action, even if it wasn't CGI rendered that well, but I still left feeling like it was an enjoyable movie. I probably wouldn't watch it again, to be honest, but it was watchable the two times that I watched it, and while I wouldn't watch it again, I would watch it in musical form because during my research, I did find that in 2004, two people wrote an off-Broadway musical based on The Last Starfighter.
And what?
And, yeah, and I went on Apple Music and downloaded the original cast recording, and I gotta tell you, it's not that bad.
I'm gonna have to look for that. Yeah, I'm giving the CGI a hard time. The biggest praise that I can give this movie is the fact that I've probably doubled my viewing of this movie just by doing this podcast, because I watched it twice as well to get all my notes in and everything like that. I had probably never seen it more than twice before, so I can at least give it praise with the fact that it's a memorable story, that after all these years and after how few times I've actually seen it, that I'm able to look at a book like Armada and say, this is The Last Starfighter. I remember the story. The guy that plays a video game and ends up recruited into a real starfighter. But man, I have trouble getting behind the lame action and the bad special effects. I'm going right down the middle on this one. I'm going 50. I'm hitting this one harder than much than you guys are, that's for sure.
My score is probably more based on the effort. I appreciate the effort that was put in to make this movie. In a time where CGI was just so new, I get it's not great, but like I read that Gunstar was like 750 polygons to render that thing. That's a lot of work.
They're better special effects than I'd be able to do. But
yeah, I think the scores will probably go up if you were like on something and then you watch it.
Quite scores possibly, but I don't know. I gotta take off those nostalgia goggles. You know, I gotta try to look past everything that I used to love about this movie, and the story kind of holds up, but the everything else around it just doesn't.
You know, I think like you could take the exact same script and shoot it today, and just changing the CGI, or even like pulling a Lucas and doing the special edition and redoing all the CGI parts, and then it'd be like a movie you could show today, and no one would even know the difference.
Imagine shoots first, and
yeah, just imagine if you got like a whole team, like if you got your A team of people surrounding this movie, from the writers, you know, you rewrite it a little bit, choreographers, editing, and then all the CGI. That could be a pretty damn good movie.
It could be. Okay. Well, that's The Last Starfighter, and that's our show for this week. So a big thank you today to our special guest, Kingsley Leung. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, and we hope to have you back sometime. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to Apple or Spotify or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. Doesn't really matter what you say, but it's those 5 stars that drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And if you want to support the podcast, you can contact us by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com, all one word. You can follow us on Facebook. We have a Facebook group. Just search I Used to Like This One. We're at I Used to Like This One on Instagram, and at I Used to Like This One with numbers instead of letters on Twitter. On social media is where you can get the heads up on what movies we're watching if you want to watch them before you listen to the show.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter and the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.